be out here on the road together. Carson has no idea what Leo is up to. It's like they're sad motel guests whose paths cross occasionally. But he could come driving down the road any second. And what would he make of this? Carson at 12:15, communing with their sister's brother-in-law. Carson, please stop. She keeps walking. Please, Carson, I love you.
I love you too, she thinks.
She has never been in love before and has never said the words to a man. She's a late bloomer in this, but she knows that this is what love feels like. It feels like jumping out of a plane with a parachute that has been packed by someone who's assured you that yes, it will open, and you will float safely to the ground. She walks over to where Zach's Audi is idling and kisses him, right out in the open.
See you tomorrow,
he asks. She nods, and he drives away. Vivi leaps out of her chair.
No, she says, absolutely not. I refuse to believe it.
Believe it, Martha says.
Carson and Zach Bridgman?
Yes. Vivi is stunned. She's aghast. Carson and Zach? This had been going on while Vivi was alive? While Carson was living under Vivi's roof? Vivi thinks about her final morning on Earth. Of Carson coming home at 5:30 a.m. Had she been out with Zach? Vivi thinks back to the night at the Oyster Catcher when Zach and Pamela sat down at the bar. Carson had been flustered. There was no denying it. She'd stammered, knocked over the menus, spilled bourbon over the rim of the glass. Had they planned that cute little meeting, or had Zach ambushed her? Was he cruel enough to bring his wife to the bar where Carson was working without warning her? Vivi has depicted some scandalous affairs in her novels, but never anything quite this sordid.
Eh, Martha says, some of them were pretty sordid. Let's not forget Clay and Megan in Main Street Gossip.
But he's, Vivi calculates. She thinks Zach is a year older than Pamela, so he's about 42. And Carson is 21, twice her age.
It happens.
I'm the novelist. Vivi says, I know it happens. But no, sorry, this I can't abide. How long has this been going on? Who else knows? Does Willa know? Definitely not. Vivi thinks back. Did Carson and Zach have a close relationship in the past? Not that she'd noticed. Was this thing going on when Willa got married? At the wedding, Vivi had been too consumed with herself, JP, Amy, Dennis, and Lucinda to worry about Carson.
I'm glad you advised me to save my nudges, because I'm putting an end to this.
You can't, Martha says. They've fallen in love. Breaking that up requires more than just a nudge.
So now you're telling me my nudges won't work?
They'll work, Martha says. What I'm telling you is a nudge is a nudge. It's exactly what a parent tries to do in real life. But you don't have the power to stop love or change it.
You've got to be kidding me.
I'm sorry, Vivian. And with that, Martha disappears through the green door. Vivi is allowed to use the hours when her world is asleep to travel back in her memories. Every single moment of her life, days, weeks, months, even entire years that she has long forgotten, can be revisited in crystal clear detail, as though she's living it again. She isn't bound by chronology. She's like a contestant on a game show. She spins the wheel and sees where it lands. My first summer on Nantucket. Sure, why not? It's 1991. She has just graduated from Duke. She has no job and no prospects, but she did win the Creative Writing Award at graduation, which came with a $5,000 prize. $5,000 is a fortune. It's enough that she can ignore her mother's pleas to come home to Parma. You can get a job at the mall, take a typing class, and go with Savannah to Nantucket for the summer.
It'll be so great, Savannah said when they were back in Durham packing up their dorm room. I have a part-time job in a needlepoint store on Main Street, and when I'm not working, We can hang out on Matakasham Beach. We can go to the Chicken Box and the Muse at night.
I'll have to get a job too, Vivi said.
You'll be writing, Savannah said. You're bringing your word processor, right?
Right, Vivi said.
But her voice faltered because she wasn't sure she considered writing a job. A job was supposed to produce income. Maybe she could write in the mornings, then wait tables or work retail. She wanted to use the $5,000 as a nest egg, not as pocket money to blow through during her fun Nantucket summer. Her fun Nantucket summer. On the ferry, Vivi and Savannah sit on the top deck with the sun in their faces and the wind blowing their hair back like they're a couple of J. Crew models. The island comes into view, sailboats in the harbor, the town skyline, such as it is, consisting of two church steeples. When the girls disembark, Savannah waves at her mother, Mary Catherine, who is driving an ancient Jeep Wagoneer with wood panel sides. Mrs. Hamilton helps them load their luggage into the back, while Savannah's yellow lab, Bromley, chases his tail in excitement.
I swear, Vivian, you brought so much luggage. I'd think you were planning on spending the summer, Mary Catherine says.
Vivi's mouth opens. Savannah squeezes Vivi's wrist in a way that Vivi knows means don't respond and says,
You sit up front, Vivi, so you can see. I'll sit in the back with Bromley.
On the way to the house, Vivi cranes her neck trying to take it all in. The bike shops, the pizza place, the Nantucket Whaling Museum, a young woman in a yellow sundress crossing the street with an armload of flowers. When Mary Catherine said Vivi brought enough luggage to make her think she was spending the summer, what did that mean? Isn't she spending the summer? Vivi tries not to panic, although she has nowhere to go except back to Ohio, where she'll end up working at one of the Parmatown Mall kiosks that sell markers with disappearing ink, or paper planes that fly in loop-the-loops, or, even worse, she'll be stuffing her legs into nylons and showing up at some blocky office building to become a Kelly girl. But she has her heart set on a summer at the beach. The Hamilton Summer Home, Entre Nous, is on Union Street in a row of what Mary Catherine calls antiques. Vivi thought antiques were pieces of furniture or cars, not houses. The home was built in 1822 by Oliver Hamilton. It has white clapboard siding, black shutters, a black front door with a silver scallop shell knocker, and huge blooming hydrangea bushes flanking the friendship stairs, seven steps on either side of the door that ascend to meet at a landing. When Vivi enters, she holds her breath. She knows, somehow, that this is a moment she'll remember until the day she dies, and beyond, as it turns out. Vivi had thought the house would be beachy, like an upscale version of the place they rented in Wrightsville during spring break. But this house has Persian rugs, chandeliers, a grandfather clock, and a huge vase of Asiatic lilies on a marble-topped table in the foyer. The dog bounds inside and sniffs at Vivi's crotch for what seems like an indecent amount of time while Vivi tries to pry his muzzle away. Nobody else seems to notice, but Vivi feels exposed, as if even the dog has rooted her out as a stranger. The house is the grandest Vivi has ever been inside. The staircase has a runner held across each step with a brass rail, and Savannah points at the scrimshaw button embedded in the cap of the newel post at the bottom of the balustrade. It was placed there when good old Ollie paid off the mortgage in 1826. Vivi peers into the formal living room to the right of the stairs and the dining room to the left, each room with a brick fireplace. Savannah leads her down the hall to a library, which is everything you'd want an at-home library to be. Built-in shelves hold rows and rows of books, the requisite leather-bound kind, but also the rainbow spines of popular hardbacks and an entire swath of battered paperbacks. There's a deep leather armchair where apparently someone has been sitting recently. A copy of Moby Dick lies splayed open on the seat. Vivi can't help herself. She picks the book up. In the margins are notes in faded pencil.
I was just revisiting Melville,
Mary Catherine says. That's the copy I studied from at Smith, if you can believe it.
Vivi sets the book down with some reverence now. The library isn't just for show. It's the place where Mary Catherine can revisit Melville and reflect on the thoughts she had as a younger person. Vivi understands that she's in a home where things aren't put out for show. The furnishings have meaning, provenance. It's mortifying to compare this home, Savannah's second home, to the place Vivi grew up, with its wall-to-wall carpeting, crucifixes everywhere, the long, fancy mirror at the end of the hall bought on sale from the furniture department at Higbee's. Vivi wishes she hadn't sold all her books back to the student bookstore at the end of the year. She, too, wrote in the margins, this was a detriment to their resale value, and now she will never be able to revisit her musings. She will never be able to hand off her copy of Franny and Zoe to one of her children and say, I read this at 19. Let me know what you think. From now on, she decides, she's saving her books. Beyond the library is a huge, wide, bright kitchen, which is many different rooms in one. In front of a row of windows is a harvest table set with 10 Windsor chairs. Against the opposite wall is an enormous cast iron range with an imposing hood. The backsplash tile is painted with pictures of fruits and vegetables labeled in French, haricots verts, artichauts, pêche. There's a plaid Orvis dog bed in the corner, and beyond that, a mudroom where Bromley's leashes hang alongside yellow rain slickers. A straw market basket rests on a simple wooden bench that is probably where good old Ollie Hamilton used to sit to put on his boots. The kitchen has a square island topped in dark marble. There's a prep sink at one end and three bar stools at the other. Someone has set out a cutting board with a block of pale cheese, a stick of salami, and a dish of purplish olives. Alcohol? Savannah asks. She pulls a bottle of wine from a fridge that seems to hold only wine, and Vivi can tell it's not the cheap stuff that she and Savannah used to buy at Kroger and drink in the dorms before they went out. Savannah takes two wine goblets down from a rack over their heads that Vivi hadn't even noticed and says, Let me show you upstairs. The hallway of the second floor is long, with a barrel-vaulted roof. Doors that lead to bedrooms, or bathrooms, or closets, are all closed. At the end of the hall is a rounded niche holding the most impressive model ship Vivi has ever seen. The house is like a museum. There isn't one cheap or inauthentic thing in it. They ascend another set of stairs to the third floor, Savannah's floor, the renovated attic. The massive, airy, slope-ceilinged space is entirely white. Walls, trim, curtains, king canopy bed. The rag rug is done in vivid rainbow stripes, and hanging on the walls is Savannah's childhood artwork, finger paintings, crayon drawings. It's a self-portrait. Savannah with green hair and red pants drawn like two long boxes that finally moves Vivi to tears. She brought home school projects. Turkeys created by tracing her hand, Easter bunnies with cotton ball tails, even a tessellation Vivi slaved over for her geometry class in 9th grade. And she's certain they all went into the trash. Vivi's family never documented or celebrated itself because neither of her parents believed their family was worth it. They were just trying to survive, and they didn't even succeed at that. What's wrong? Savannah asks. Vivi can't explain what she's feeling without sounding petty. My mother didn't keep my artwork. I have no personal history to display. Savannah will no doubt say she's envious because Vivi's parents aren't all over her. Vivi has what Savannah wants, freedom. Your mother doesn't know I'm staying all summer, Vivi says. Does she? I don't care about my mother, Savannah says, waving a hand. Her opinion matters not. And you don't have to worry about sharing my bed because... She strides over to a door that Vivi thinks is a closet and opens it to reveal another bedroom. This one just big enough to hold a double bed, a dresser, and a desk set by a tiny window. Vivi gazes out. She can see the harbor in the distance.
The tiny room is perfect. It's compact and sensible. She can write here while looking at the water for inspiration. Tears drip down Vivi's face.
How long does she think I'm staying?
Oh, it's this stupid family rule. House guests get 1 week.
Why didn't you tell me this? Vivi says. You said I could stay for the summer.
You can stay for the summer, Savannah says. I just have to speak to my father in person. Mr. Hamilton lives and works in Boston during the week. He arrives on Friday afternoons and leaves on Monday mornings.
What if that doesn't work?
It always works, Savannah says.
But what if it doesn't? Vivi says. Just give me the plan for the worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario? Savannah says. Listen, my parents never ever come up here, and they go to bed early. We could just say that you found a place to rent and that every once in a while you sleep over. I'll take care of cleaning your room, doing the sheets, and whatnot while my mother is at the club.
You're suggesting I hide here all summer?
Vivi asks.
Like Anne Frank?
This makes them both laugh. But is it really funny? And is Vivi really so far off base? After spending a few days on Nantucket, lounging on Nobadeer Beach, driving around town in Savannah's bare-bones Jeep, no top, no doors, no back seat, riding a couple of the old Schwinns in the garage out to Sconset to see the first bloom of the climbing roses, dancing all night at the chicken box, Vivi is ready to consider the hidden refugee plan. When Mr. Hamilton shows up on Friday afternoon, still in his pinstriped business suit, he's the managing partner in a big law firm on State Street, the household becomes far more festive. Mr. Hamilton makes his famous frozen margaritas, and they drink them while sitting at a table by the pool.
How are you liking Nantucket? Mr. Hamilton asks Vivi.
I love it, she says. I never want to leave.
Ah, but leave you must, Mrs. Hamilton says. Monday, yes? Have you booked your ferry?
Can't Vivi stay a few more days? Savannah asks. Please?
A few more days won't hurt, Mr. Hamilton says, filling enormous tulip-shaped glasses from the blender.
You've both clearly forgotten that Patrick and Deborah are coming with the children, Mary Catherine says. She offers Vivi a close-lipped smile. My brother, his second wife, their blended family of 6 children. I'm afraid there won't be an inch of extra space.
Vivi mumbles, excuse me, and slips away from the table.
The margarita is churning in her stomach. Patrick and Deborah and their 6 kids are family, and Vivi is not. She has to go. Bromley follows Vivi into the house. He has become her devotee this week, always at her heels, and she has to shoo him away so she can close the powder room door. Of all the rooms in this remarkable house, the downstairs powder room is the one Vivi loves the most. The walls are plastered from floor to ceiling with framed snapshots of the Hamilton family on Nantucket. There must be over 200 pictures, and Vivi has spent a long time studying them. Most are from when Savannah was growing up. There are photos taken on the beach, on sailboats, at picnics, on the tennis court, in the pool, at the 4th of July festivities on Main Street. There's a picture of Savannah's old dachshund, Herman Munster, lying across the sofa in the library. There are pictures of a younger Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton hugging, kissing, hoisting cocktails. Vivi has scrutinized each photograph like a detective looking for clues. Now, she scans the wall for people who might be Patrick and Deborah or Patrick and his first wife. There's a knock on the door. Savannah.
Are you okay? Please don't hate me. This is all my fault.
It is all Savannah's fault. Who invites someone to spend the summer at her parents' house without checking with them first? Savannah knew the family rule about house guests and yet made no mention of it. She led Vivi to believe that this Nantucket life could, for one summer, be hers. This wouldn't be so bad if Vivi hadn't fallen so completely, irrevocably in love with the island and all its wonders.
I'll be right out,
Vivi says in a carefree, sing-song voice. She studies the Hamilton family picture that is right above the light switch. It's of Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton and Savannah when Savannah is 17 or 18, so maybe the summer before Duke, which was the summer that Vivi spent every waking moment with Brett Caspian. The Hamiltons are at a bonfire on the beach. They're all end-of-summer tan, and Savannah appears to be shoving the last bite of a hot dog into her mouth. Vivi's and Savannah's lives could not have been more different that summer. But since then, their lives have converged, and now, 4 years later, they are best friends. Change happens in an instant. One girl offers another her bottle of Breck shampoo, and a friendship is formed. Vivi has money in the bank. She can use some of it to rent a room and buy a secondhand bike. She can get a job. She can stay here on her own. She will stay, she decides. Somehow, some way, she will make this island hers. She will become a Nantucketer. 20 or 30 years from now, she will be able to tell the story of how she refused to overstay her welcome at the Hamiltons, and so she forged her own way. Between us, she imagined saying to friends, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was the defining moment of my life. This week has been about more than Vivi from Ohio being exposed to wealth and privilege. It has been about Vivi finding a home. And someday, she tells herself, she will have a powder room just like this one, with pictures of her and her husband and their children, all of them smiling in gratitude at their own good fortune. Well, Vivi in the sky thinks. She had forgotten the intensity of her emotion when she'd learned she would have to leave the Hamiltons back in June of 1991. Savannah has never forgiven herself. She has apologized at least 100 times over the years. Vivi succeeded. She stayed on Nantucket and created a life and family. How that happened is a memory for a different night. Vivi wishes she had taken the time to decorate the powder room in Money Pit with family photographs like the Hamiltons. But who was she kidding? That house had 100 projects more pressing, like Leo's shower leaking onto the dining room table and a family of mice living behind the washer and dryer. Maybe one of the kids would do the project now that Vivi was gone. Maybe Savannah would recall the umpteen times Vivi said she wanted to recreate the powder room of Entre Nous, and she would prompt the kids to do it. Not doing the powder room is a regret, albeit a small one. There are other, far bigger regrets. But Vivi will think about those later. Leo. After 2 full weeks of radio silence, Marissa shows up at the house on a Monday, Leo's only day off from the boat basin. He opens the door to find her holding a Bakewell tart with feathered pink and white icing. The fluted crust is golden brown, but there's one imperfection where it looks like the crust crumbled and has been pinched together. Did you? Leo swallows. He's happy to have the tart to look at instead of Marissa's face. Make Mary Berry's Bakewell tart? Did you make that yourself?
Not exactly, Marissa says. I took a picture of it to the bake shop and asked them to make it because I know you've always wanted to try it.
Oh, Leo says. So you paid someone to do it for you?
It's an apology, Leo. I'm sorry about what I said to Cruz on the beach, and I'm obviously sorry about your mom. Just let me in, please.
Leo takes a deep breath and holds open the door. They pick up right where they left off, hanging out all the time. They used to watch the Great British Baking Show, ironically. They would imitate the accents and use words like arduous and intuitive. But now Leo watches it as an escape. The biggest disaster under the tent is dough not rising or pastry cream curdling, or fruit that is too soft or watery leading to a soggy crust. Leo doesn't have to think about his mother, dead, or about his former best friend,
who is quite possibly the reason his mother is dead. The one time that Marissa and Leo tiptoe close to the topic of Cruz, Marissa whispers,
"I hate even thinking this, but it must have been him."
Alexis said Officer Falco saw him run a stop sign and then speeding less than 5 minutes before your mom got hit.
He was driving recklessly before he turned onto Kingsley, Boo. I'm sure he was so upset that he might have just erased what actually happened from his mind. He might be in complete denial, like a case of temporary insanity.
Leo has blocked Cruz on his phone and on Instagram and Snapchat. He expects Cruz to show up at the house like Marissa did, but so far, he hasn't. Leo has also blocked Peter Bridgman from his phone. He wants to pretend that the night before his mother's death, the bonfire at 40th Pole, his breakup with Marissa, and the photograph that Peter sent him never happened. Marissa tells Leo that Alexis has a new boyfriend. He's an officer in the department, and things are moving so fast that Alexis has created a Pinterest board for her wedding.
"And I decided to make one too," Marissa says. "You know, for the future."
"Make what?" Leo says, because he's only half listening.
"A Pinterest board for our wedding," Marissa says. "Here, look."
They're lying on the gurve. Leo is spooning Marissa, and Marissa is spooning her laptop.
"I chose bridesmaid dresses and flowers, though I'm thinking of switching the palette from pink to peach."
"Good idea," Leo says with false enthusiasm. He knows he won't be marrying Marissa, but he needs her right now, is the thing. He needs her badly. Without Vivi, Leo is not only lost but confused. Who's in charge of his day-to-day life now? Everyone, it seems, and no one. Leo's father, JP, suggests that Leo spend the summer at his house and maybe trade his job at the boat basin for one scooping ice cream at the cone. "No and no," Leo says. Then, because he's angry and has no place to vent, he says, "I hate Amy." He's instantly ashamed. He doesn't like Amy, but hate is a strong word, and he would never say it to her face. JP clears his throat. "What if Amy weren't around? Where's she going?" His father doesn't answer, and Leo doesn't care. He won't live with his father because he can't bear to leave his mother's house. A part of her is still here. There's Tupperware in the refrigerator that still holds her grilled zucchini dip. Half a bottle of her Dry Bar shampoo is on the shelf in the outdoor shower. It's like she's away on a book tour and might be back at any moment. Carson has been sleeping in Vivi's room. She just moved in like it was her right, and when she's not at work, she wears Vivi's clothes. This is either a healthy way to grieve or a sign of mental illness. Both Leo and Willa understand that Carson is a renegade. She acts out, demands attention, gets in nonstop trouble, makes questionable decisions, drinks, vapes, smokes weed, and was an expert at pushing every single one of their mother's buttons. However, Carson is also cool, funny, and very, very pretty. People comment on it all the time. Leo's friends always tell him how hot Carson is. Cruz had a wicked crush on her for years. Leo can't think about Cruz. Carson isn't in charge of anything following Vivi's death, except going back to work and keeping herself alive. Once the zucchini dip is gone and people have stopped dropping off lasagna and clam chowder, Leo wonders what they're supposed to eat. What will they do for money? Who's going to pay the mortgage? That's where Savannah comes in. She's handling all the business stuff, figuring out Vivi's finances, and dealing with the publication of the new book. She's the administrator of the Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page. "Do you want to read the comments people have been posting?" she asks one morning when Carson and Leo happen to be in the kitchen foraging at the same time. "No," Leo says.
"No," Carson says. "That sounds like Willa's kind of thing. Have either of you heard of a boyfriend your mom had in high school named Brett Caspian?"
"Negative," Leo says.
Mom didn't have boyfriends in high school, Carson says. She was a total nerd.
That's the story she always told me, too, Savannah says. But this guy is insisting he dated her for most of their senior year and into the summer before she left for Duke. He says he has pictures.
Ask him to send the pictures, Carson says, because I've never heard of any guy named Brett Kardashian.
Caspian, Savannah says.
He wants to talk to someone about the new book.
Crackpot, Carson says. Dead celebrity chaser. But ask for the pics.
I think I will, Savannah says. Your dad has never heard of him either.
He said he was your mother's first boyfriend, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Can we not talk about this anymore? Leo says.
Savannah leaves envelopes filled with cash for them to divvy up. Marissa takes some of the money and does a grocery shop for the house. Leo is relieved. If he goes to the Stop and Shop, he might see Cruz working. He wants to ask Marissa if she saw Cruz when she went, but he doesn't. He can't even say Cruz's name out loud. Leo eats a lot of toast with peanut butter. He gets takeout, but he has to avoid the nickel, even though all he's craving is a corned beef Reuben on marble rye with Joe's homemade Thousand Island dressing. Leo knows that he's avoiding the DeSantises, but he's surprised, even hurt, that neither Cruz nor Joe has swung by the house to check on him, and that Joe hasn't dropped off a platter of sandwiches, even though he does this every time someone on this island so much as breaks a toe. Aren't they worried about him? Don't they care?
Willa and Rip have moved out to Smith's Point, but Willa stops by every once in a while to check in. Rip is handling the police investigation because he's used to logistics and following up in his job for the insurance company. He handled the claim for the Jeep Marissa totaled the night before Vivi died. She was so upset about Leo breaking up with her that she drove the Jeep right into the bathtub out at Eel Point.
How did you get home then? Leo had asked.
I walked. This seemed very unlikely, and Leo said so. Then Marissa admitted that she'd hitched a ride with some rando coming down the Matticat Road. She couldn't call anyone because her phone had been in the car. This explained why her calls stopped that night, and it also meant that Marissa hadn't seen the photo from Peter Bridgman. Rip had Marissa's Jeep towed and taken off island. Marissa's mother, Candace, not only replaced Marissa's phone, but bought Marissa a brand new Jeep, an outlay of 50 grand at least.
Wasn't your mom angry about the Jeep? Leo asks. You ruined it yourself.
So?
So it seems like another parent might have made you deal with the consequences of your actions.
Marissa shrugs.
I was upset about our breakup.
She understands.
Leo and Marissa have been together long enough for Leo to realize that Candace Lopresti is the kind of mother who wants more than anything to be friends with her daughters. She never created any rules, mostly because she wasn't home to enforce them. She was always traveling for work. She gives Marissa and her older sister Alexis whatever they want whenever they want it, a brand new phone and a brand new Jeep to replace the ones that Marissa willfully trashed, is Candace's way of saying, I'm here for you, honey. Nothing is normal. Nothing will ever be normal again. But Leo tries to immerse himself in work at the boat basin. The clients, his golf cart, his walkie-talkie. He smiles and chats like everything is just dandy. For all the boat owners know, Leo is a cheerful, friendly Nantucket kid who is heading to the University of Colorado in the fall and doesn't have a care in the world. Every time he pockets a tip, he thinks to himself, I deserve an Oscar. Then, one morning when he's at work, Marissa calls to say that Alexis had news. Vivi's running shoes, which had mysteriously gone missing, were just found in the trash can of the Stop and Shop break room. The custodian who takes out the trash noticed them because, and no one was happy to hear this, he sometimes went through the trash looking for things of value that people threw away. He found Vivi's sneakers,
which he thought might be worth saving, until he saw they were stained with blood. Then he called the police.
I hate to say this, but it's not looking good for Cruz, Marissa says.
Why would you automatically think of Cruz? Leo says. Other people work at that store, you know.
Leo,
Marissa says.
Come on.
Vivi. She needs Martha. She needs Martha. Where's Martha? Vivi approaches the green door. She puts her ear to the panel and hears faint singing. It sounds like Fool in the Rain by Led Zeppelin. Is Vivi imagining this? It's such a great song, a song totally worthy of the afterlife. But shouldn't the choir be singing hymns or madrigals? Ever so slowly, Vivi takes hold of the knob and turns. Vivian! Suddenly, Martha swings open the door from the other side, pushing Vivi back toward the bookshelves. A new scarf, lavender in hue, is tied around Martha's ponytail, a 1950s sock hop look. What did I tell you about the door, Vivian?
I'm not supposed to open it.
I should dock you a week of viewing time, Martha says.
No, please don't. I'm sorry. You said you would come when I needed you, and I need you now. I want you to assure me that Cruz wasn't the one who hit me. I would forgive him. I would forgive that child anything. But I'm afraid the world won't forgive him. I'm afraid the court system, the judge, the Nantucket police, and my own kids won't forgive him. Please, Martha, tell me Cruz wasn't the one who hit me.
You seem a little slow in learning the rules, Martha says. I can't tell you who hit you or didn't hit you.
Is that because you don't know, or because you don't want to tell me?
Oh, Vivian, the same rules apply to us here as down there.
That's not really true, Vivian thinks. Martha shakes her head, and the scarf moves like a curtain in the breeze. Some things you have to figure out on your own. The Chief. Dixon, again with the bad news. A janitor at the Stop and Shop found blood-stained sneakers in the trash in the break room, and he called the police to report it. Dixon went himself to retrieve the sneakers, and they exactly matched the description of Vivi's missing sneakers.
For crying out loud, the chief says,
because his mind travels right to Cruz DeSantis.
This is good, Dixon says. They were lost, now they're found. And you know, chief, the DeSantis kid works at the Stop and Shop. Did the janitor find the clothes as well? No, just the shoes.
Just the shoes? That makes no sense.
And what's valuable, from a forensic standpoint, is the clothes, the shorts and the tank, in case there are flecks of paint.
Every contact leaves a trace.
Do you want me to bring the DeSantis kid in? Dixon asks. Not yet, the chief says. I need to think.
The chief asks Dixon to air freight the shoes to Lisa Hitt on the Cape. He should probably request a homicide detective from the state police. The Greek would be his best option. But he doesn't want to call one in just yet. The Greek is a busy man, and they have no forensic evidence tying this death to any suspects. Cruz DeSantis is a smart kid. He's too smart to tamper with evidence, too smart to throw bloody sneakers into the trash at his place of employment. Right? The chief will go talk to him. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. A phone call to the Stop and Shop confirms that Cruz is working. The chief arranges for him to take a break so that Cruz can help with an ongoing investigation. The chief is waiting out back by the employee entrance when Cruz comes out. He looks tired, sick, traumatized.
Cruz. I heard the news already, Cruz says. I work here, Chief Capanesh. Right, the chief says. Let's take a drive.
They have only 30 minutes, so they can't go far. The chief goes around the small rotary, then the big rotary. Traffic is bad. Everyone is driving while talking on a cell phone or texting. It's amazing there aren't motor vehicle homicides every day.
I know Donald found running shoes in the trash of the break room, Cruz says. I didn't put them there. Why would I have Vivi sneakers?
They went missing from the hospital, the chief says. Somewhere between the hospital and the station, we lost track of them. The clothes still haven't been recovered.
Check my car, check my house. I don't have the clothes. I never touched or saw or knew about any of this. Why would I?
Calm down, son, the chief says.
I've been pulled out of work to ride around with the chief of police, Cruz says. Would you be calm in this situation?
No.
I didn't hit Vivi, Cruz says. And again, there's something in the tone and timbre of his voice that makes the chief want to believe him. I found her. Finding her wasn't a crime. The chief takes a left off Pulpus Road toward Monomoy. It's been 3 years since the last homicide on Nantucket. The maid of honor in a lavish wedding at a waterfront estate called Summerland was found floating in the harbor. They chalked that up to an accident, but it still irks the chief, and he knows it bothers the Greek as well. If Ed called the Greek now, he would jump at the chance to investigate this hit and run. Maybe. Or maybe he'd think it was a lost cause. Or maybe he'd think the answer was sitting right there in the front seat.
You lied to me, Cruz.
The kid says nothing.
You told me you were driving to the house from your house, but you weren't.
No. This admission is a start.
Where were you coming from?
Hooper Farm.
What were you doing on Hooper Farm?
Does it matter?
I wouldn't be asking if it didn't.
I went to see someone.
A girl?
This kid, Peter Bridgman.
Bridgman?
Ed thinks.
He's Zach and Pamela's kid?
Yeah, he's my year. Just graduated. I needed to talk to him.
At 7 in the morning? What was so urgent?
Something.
Son.
It's just high school stuff, Chief, okay? But since you asked, that's where I was coming from.
Why didn't you tell me that before?
I didn't want to get into it.
You do realize that a woman is dead, and like it or not, you're part of the investigation, and you owed me the truth no matter the question.
He's using his full-on chief of police voice now, and he can see from a glimpse of the kid's face in the rearview mirror that he's nervous.
Yes. Cruz says. But I don't want to talk about that part. It has nothing to do with anything.
Except you were upset, yes? You were distracted? You ran a stop sign and went speeding down Surfside Road. Officer Falco almost pulled you over. And then a few minutes later, he got the call about Ms. Howe. So you can see how lying to me was a problem.
I did run the stop sign and I was speeding, Cruz says. I was upset. And I was distracted. But I didn't hit Vivi. I found her. She was on the ground, bleeding from her mouth, her legs sliced open. Someone hit her and left her there, Chief. And I pulled over and called 911. The woman was like a mother to me.
His voice works the edge of tears, and then, like a flipped switch, it turns to anger.
Why don't you just charge me with her murder? Everyone on this island thinks I did it. My friends, my coworkers, my so-called community. I'm black, so I must be a criminal, right?
Sit with your discomfort, Ed tells himself. The kid has every right to vent his feelings.
I'm not charging you with anything, the chief says, but you're all I've got. And I can't help thinking that if I can unravel exactly what was going on with you that morning, I can follow that thread to someone else.
The chief pulls into the small parking lot at the Monomoy Public Beach. From here, a path leads to the water. It's crowded only in the early mornings and early evenings when people are heading out in their kayaks.
Before the running shoes turned up, I could maybe have bought the theory that the driver was some summer kid, or hell, an adult, who hit Ms. Howe, got scared, and hightailed it out of there. But the shoes turning up in your place of employment makes this something else. I know it wasn't you who hit her, okay? But someone on this island wants us to think it was you.
I'm being framed. Cruz says.
Just like in the movies.
Who would do that?
The chief asks. Do you know this guy, Donald?
No, Cruz says.
I only work days.
I know Justin, the daytime custodian.
He's kind of alternative, but a good enough guy.
The chief drives back to the store.
What did you want to talk to Peter Bridgman about?
The kid shakes his head.
If you don't tell me, I'll ask Peter.
Cruz breathes out and his nostrils flare.
He took a picture on Friday at the end of this party at 40th Pole, and he sent it to me in the middle of the night. When I woke up and saw it, I called him, but he didn't answer. So I drove over to his house. Was he home? I didn't see his truck, but I thought maybe he ditched it at 40th and gotten a ride home because he'd been drinking. He has his own apartment above his parents' garage. So I went up the outdoor stairs and I knocked a bunch of times and he didn't answer, so I left. I figured he was either out somewhere or ignoring me.
Did anyone see you there?
No, Cruz says. I don't know. His parents didn't come out or anything.
So you left the Bridgman house and drove straight to the house?
Yes.
Why?
Cruz gives the chief an exasperated look.
Leo is my friend. I wanted to talk to him.
Did going over there have anything to do with this picture?
Yeah.
I could see Leo had gotten the picture from Peter as well, so I wanted to talk to him about it. Plus, we'd had that fight.
When he punched you and gave you the shiner?
See? You already know everything.
Do you mind my asking what the picture was of?
Yes, Cruz says. I mind.
They've arrived back at the store.
Can I go, please?
The chief will talk to the night custodian, Donald, and also to the Bridgman kid.
Yes, he says. You can go.
Amy. She comes home from work with a bottle of Clif Leday Cabernet, one of JP's favorite splurge wines, and the bourbon marinated steak tips from the Nantucket Meat and Fish Market. It's too early for local corn, but this is the perfect opportunity for Amy to try a warm potato salad recipe that she found in the New York Times cooking column. Amy finds JP sitting in their bedroom with the air conditioning running on high. Note, if she were in the bedroom alone with the AC running full blast like this, he would turn it down, saying, "This thing burns money."
"Hello," she says. She's surprised to see him here. She thought he said he'd be home around 8.
He whips around as though she's caught him at something. And sure enough, in front of him on the bed is a cardboard box filled with pictures of Vivi, of him and Vivi together, of the kids when they were little. Amy is so busy scanning the pictures that it takes her a minute to realize that JP is crying. Amy walks out of the bedroom, closing the door behind her, and goes into the kitchen to compose herself. Wine. She needs wine. The Clif Leday is too precious to open, but she finds half a bottle of Whispering Angel Rosé from the night before. She pours a glass and takes a sip. It wasn't pornography, she thinks, and she knows plenty of women who surprise their husbands or partners while they're in the middle of that. But this is maybe even worse. All those pictures of Vivi overlapping one another. It was like something pulled from Amy's nightmares. Vivi is dead, Amy reminds herself. She is never coming back, so she is no longer competition. JP can pine for her all he wants. Lorna said, "The man should be allowed to grieve. They were married 16 years, Pigeon. She's the mother of his children." Does Amy have it in her to be a supportive partner right now? Yes, of course. Holding the wine, she re-enters the bedroom. She places a gentle hand on JP's back. "How are you doing?" He shakes his head. "I can't believe she's gone. I just can't wrap my mind around it." He holds up a picture of Vivi with a red rose between her teeth. Amy wants to snatch it out of his hand and rip it in half. Amy will not nurture this jealousy,
She will let it go. She was so pretty, Amy says. So alive.
JP smiles up at Amy, grateful for this compliment about his ex-wife. Amy sits on the far corner of the bed and sifts through the photographs. Where has he been hiding these? She thought she had checked out every nook and cranny of the house. This is a treasure trove of images of JP's life before Amy. Vivi and JP in front of the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. Vivi falling forward on ice skates. Vivi drinking hot chocolate with a dab of whipped cream on her nose. There are wedding photos. Vivi's dress was an off-the-shoulder snow-white satin gown with a nipped-in waist and a full three-quarter-length skirt poofed by tulle underneath. It's not Amy's taste at all, but Vivi, of course, looks radiant with her cute pixie cut and her dramatic red lips. Savannah, her maid of honor, wore a dowdy Laura Ashley print. This must have been before Savannah made her switch to neutrals, or maybe this dress was the reason for the switch. There are pictures from various travels, a deserted beach, a hole-in-the-wall restaurant in some far-flung, dusty town, a ski slope, Big Ben, the Colosseum, the Sydney Opera House, Vivi in front of a cityscape that is either Toronto or Seattle. Amy is afraid to ask which. There are the new baby pictures. Vivi in a bed at Nantucket Cottage Hospital with Willa, then with Carson as Willa grumpily looks on. There are Christmas pictures, one of the babies tucked under the tree like a present, and Thanksgiving, Vivi, JP, two of the kids, Savannah, Lucinda, and Penny Rosen. There are Nantucket summer photos, picnics on the beach at 40th Pole, striped bass on the line, Vivi lying across the bow of Lucinda's sailboat, Arabesque, JP and Vivi at the galley for dinner, Vivi in a beach chair with a blanket draped over her in Lucinda's front yard as fireworks are shot off a barge in the harbor on the 4th of July. Amy's heart dissolves a little more with each photo. She never had to witness the home she wrecked before this moment. Wow. It's a lot, as people say. Of course, what JP doesn't have pictures of is Vivi being condescending or dismissive or too busy to properly tend to her marriage. There aren't pictures of the fight they once had when Vivi threw a glass that shattered against the tile floor and woke the children. Vivi and JP's marriage broke up for a reason. And though everyone believes that reason was Amy Van Pelt, they had been unhappy long before Amy stepped into JP's wine shop. Amy is worried. Now that Vivi is dead, that narrative might be rewritten. Vivi might be remembered as a saint whom JP wronged by falling prey to temptress Amy. She decides to play devil's advocate, see what happens. You two look so happy in this picture, she says, holding up a shot of Vivi and JP at Carson's christening. They're standing at the altar, the baby balanced between them, their expressions manic. Carson had colic, JP says. We were up all night every night with her. Those are two exhausted people right there. You two should have stayed together, Amy says frankly. I would have quietly disappeared so you two could have given it another shot. Vivi didn't want to give it another shot, JP says. She threw in the towel. Well, in her defense, you cheated on her. Yeah, but what? Amy swallows despite the rock-hard lump in her throat. Yeah, but you didn't mean it? Yeah, but it was a mistake. I was a mistake? I was nothing more than a strategic move on the chessboard? These thoughts, Amy realizes, have been lurking in the swampy depths of her mind for 10 years. Amy, please, JP says. Please what? She says. Please don't be ridiculous, is what she wants him to say. Our love is real. Our relationship is strong. We have not been dating for 10 years and living together for 3 just because I needed a warm body by my side. Please, can we not talk about this right now? We probably should have a talk at some point, but not tonight. I don't have the energy. Amy is stopped by this. They should have a talk at some point?
What does that mean?
She thinks of the ring box in JP's dresser drawer. Maybe the talk he's referring to will include, finally, a proposal. But somehow she doesn't think so.
I bought a bottle of the Cliff Ledet, she says, and some nice steak tips. I have that potato salad recipe I want to try. It has a bacon dressing.
I won't be here for dinner, JP says.
What?
Amy says. She takes a nice long drink of her wine, but it has no more effect than if she were drinking pink water.
Where are you going?
I'm having dinner on Union Street, he says, at Savannah's. She invited me when she drove me home from Vivi's reception, and tonight was the night that worked for both of us. I should have told you this morning. I'm sorry.
Amy knows to ignore her base instincts. She smiles.
Not a problem. The steak tips can wait. I may call Lorna and see if she wants to grab a bite at the Gaslight.
Good idea, he says.
Then he adds,
thank you for being understanding. I appreciate it. This can't be easy for you.
Amy gets into the outdoor shower where she cries hot, ugly tears and wails into the sumptuous white Turkish towels from Serena and Lily that JP insists on. She has a glass of the Cliff Ledet resting on the changing bench. The steak tips could wait, but that beautiful Cabernet could not. And the second she shuts the water off, she drinks lavishly. She isn't sure how to triage her pain. What hurts the worst? JP is going to Savannah's for dinner, where the two of them will talk about Vivi, memories that have nothing to do with Amy. Amy will, for the 2 or 3 hours that JP is on Union Street, at Entre Nous, a house so divine it demands envy, be erased. JP's utter devastation and his regret as he pored over the photographs is another kind of pain. And his flat declaration that they should talk is worrisome, to say the least. Amy texts Lorna.
JP informed me he's going to dinner tonight at Savannah's house.
She waits. Lorna is her best friend. There won't be any need for further explanation.
WTF?
Exactly, Amy thinks. She texts,
can you meet me at the Gaslight in an hour? Girls' night out.
Wish I could, Pigeon, but I'm on the boat over to Hyannis. I have the doctor bright and early.
Ugh, right. Lorna has an appointment at Cape Cod Hospital. There was something in her mammogram that needed a second look. If JP had let Amy know his plans a little earlier, Amy would have taken the ferry over with Lorna. They could have eaten at Pan d'Avignon and shopped at the mall like regular off-island people. Amy could have been there for Lorna's appointment.
No worries, Amy says. Good luck tomorrow. Call if you need me.
Now Amy needs to make a decision. Stay home or go out alone? Go out alone, she thinks. She pulls her sexiest dress out of the closet and lays it across the bed where JP will be sure to see it. He comes out of the bathroom in his boxers, his face slathered with shaving cream.
You're shaving? Amy says. Is this a special occasion then?
JP shrugs and goes back into the bathroom. He doesn't even glance at the dress. Amy drinks another glass, 2, of the Cliff Ledet, but there's still half a bottle, a third of a bottle, left for another night. She's wearing the sexy black dress. Black is so forgiving, and she feels good. It's not weird that she's going out alone, she tells herself, or that in the 10 years she's lived here, she has made only one friend. She imagines herself as a character in a Vivian Howe novel. Those women are always venturing out solo and finding a good time. The Gaslight used to be a movie theater but has been reimagined as a live music venue. It has a pressed tin ceiling and a wall of vintage turntables and speakers. There's a stage with a hot pink neon sign that says Gaslight over the drum set. The crowd at the bar is lively, the food is delicious, and the cocktails are the kind that have been created by a mixologist and include ingredients Amy has never heard of. There's one open seat at the bar.
Amy imagines this conveniently happens in Vivi's novels as well. And Amy doesn't recognize anyone, another blessing. The bartender is a big, strapping bear of a man named Nick. He's a Nantucket celebrity. He says,
"Are you waiting for someone, ma'am?"
"Yes," Amy says brightly, "my friend Lorna."
"Lorna from RJ Miller?" Nick says, "she cuts my hair." "She should have texted me to let me know you were coming. I would have saved you two seats."
"May I please have a blackout Barbie?" Amy asks. "Two, actually. I want to have one here waiting for Lorna when she arrives." The blackout Barbie is a cocktail made with fresh-picked strawberries from Bartlett's farm, lemon juice, tequila, and a splash of cava. It's garnished with thyme blossoms and served with an oversized round ice cube. It's delicious. Amy drinks both hers and Lorna's in short order, and after she asks Nick for a third, she says, "I guess Lorna isn't coming."
"Yeah, I texted her," Nick says. "She's off island."
Amy isn't sure if she should act surprised or just keep rolling. She decides on the latter. "In that case, I'm ordering food. How about the cheeseburger bao buns and the poke nachos?" Amy's cocktail comes before her food. She drinks it while studying the other people at the bar as though she's an anthropologist. The clientele is young and stunning. Everyone is filled with joy and bubbly laughter, and Amy feels worse and worse about herself with every passing second. Where did she go wrong? Well, she knows where. She should never have gotten involved with a married man. She could still end things and start a new relationship with someone like Nick. Or maybe Nick is too young. He is too young. Amy's food comes, but for once, Amy just isn't herself and isn't hungry. She asks Nick for to-go boxes. She would like the check, please.
"You got it," Nick says.
She tries to ignore the pity in his voice.
"The band starts up at 10 if you want to come back then."
"Thanks," Amy says. And for a second, she feels like a strong, independent woman who might be back to enjoy the band if the spirit moves her. Maybe I'll do that. Out on the street, she has an idea. Then she tries to talk herself out of it. She puts her to-go containers in the front seat of her car. Home, she thinks. Go home. But she's drunk. She shouldn't drive. She should walk it off. And if her walk happens to take her down Union Street, is that a crime? She strolls along until she reaches Entrée Nue. The two onion lamps, one on either side of the front door, are lit, and the front windows are bright, but the rooms appear unoccupied. Amy has never been inside the house, so she isn't sure of the layout, though the kids used to swim in the pool all the time back before Vivi put in her own pool at Money Pit. Amy sees a discreet flagstone path that leads between the hedges just beyond the driveway. She checks the street, deserted. She sneaks around the side of the house to the backyard. She fears motion detector lights will announce her trespassing, but the back is quiet. Accent lights illuminate the teal-blue rectangle of the pool. The back of the house is all windows, and the lights are on so Amy can see, clear as day, Savannah and JP sitting at the kitchen island, a bottle of Casa Dragones tequila and a bowl of popcorn between them. Amy tiptoes to the windows so she can get a better look and try to hear what they're saying, but the windows are closed. There's air conditioning. Savannah has on white jeans and a black tank. She's barefoot, wears no makeup or jewelry, and her hair is piled on top of her head in a bun. She's talking, blinking rapidly, sipping tequila, and then her expression crumples and she starts to cry. JP stands up. Please let him be leaving, Amy thinks. There's no sign of dinner. Maybe they've already eaten, or maybe popcorn was the most Savannah could manage. JP holds out his arms, and Savannah falls into them like a woman in a movie and starts sobbing into JP's chest. He places one hand on her back and one on the back of her head and starts rocking side to side. This is awful. If Amy had just stayed home and imagined what was transpiring here at Entre Nous, between us, it couldn't have been any more traumatizing than this.
They're commiserating, Amy thinks. They lost someone important to them both, and this dinner is necessary so they can talk and heal.
Amy just has to be patient. Savannah raises her face and gazes at JP with a vulnerable expression. Are they going to kiss? Are they? How many times has JP told Amy in detail what a bitch he thinks Savannah is? He was so ruthless that Amy found herself defending Savannah.
She started an important charity. She saves children's lives. And she's got great style.
The moment lingers on, the two of them seemingly suspended in the moment just before a kiss. Amy runs out of the yard. She catches her toe on the edge of one of the flagstones and goes flying to the ground, scraping her knee. She gets to her feet. She needs to go home and check JP's top drawer to make sure her beautiful engagement ring is still there. But as she reaches the sidewalk and heads to her car, she knows she won't find it. She knows it's gone. Her leg is bleeding, but she doesn't care. She won't get home before JP. She wants him to get home first and wonder where she is. JP and Savannah? Impossible. Amy is sure he'll pull away and say he has to go, and all the way home he'll wonder what came over him, getting to the edge of an intimate moment like that. Amy reaches Main Street and thinks, club car piano bar? She can mix in with the mass of humanity belting out, stop dragging my heart around and no one will realize she's by herself. But when she reaches the club car, there's a line out the door. No, thank you. She considers Straight Wharf, the clientele is too young, and Crewe, she has spent enough money at Crewe this summer. She decides to head back to the Gaslight since Nick sort of invited her. She can hear the band playing before she enters. She stops at the vending machine at the entry that dispenses tiny bottles of Moët & Chandon champagne for $20 a pop, as it were. It's gimmicky and exorbitant, but suddenly, Amy wants champagne to celebrate the hideous mess her life is rapidly becoming. The champagne is delivered ice cold. Amy drinks straight from the bottle, then wanders over to the bar, and believe it or not, her very same stool is unoccupied. It's magical, as though novelist Vivi has been holding this seat for Amy's eventual return. But Amy's not a character. She's real. She hoists her petite bottle of Moët up to Nick in a cheers.
Hey, the guy next to her says, your leg is bleeding.
Amy looks down at her leg. Yes, it's pretty gruesome. There's blood running down into her sandal. The guy hands her a stack of cocktail napkins and she looks up at him. It's Dennis.
Oh, Amy says. Hey.
Dennis laughs. We have to stop meeting like this.
He peers behind her.
Where's your boyfriend?
Who?
Amy says, and Dennis laughs again. Dennis looks okay. He has a tan that ends at his shirt collar, and his eyes look intensely blue. There's a Cisco whale's tail in front of him. Is he here alone?
Are you here alone?
I am, he says. Beats sitting home in an empty house.
Amy nods. Why is it fine for a man to sit at a bar alone, but nothing short of pathetic for a woman?
JP is having dinner tonight with Savannah.
Ah, Dennis says. That must be tough on you.
It is, Amy says, blinking against tears.
Why is Dennis Letty the only person who has considered her feelings? She raises her bottle to Dennis's blue can. And they both drink.
I'll watch your seat, Dennis says. Why don't you go clean up your leg and then we can dance?
Dance with Dennis? Amy thinks. One part of her rebels against hooking up with another man that Vivi got to first. The other part says, couldn't hurt, sounds like fun.
Okay, she says. Be right back.
Vivi. When Vivi swoops down to check on Savannah, her BFF, the godmother of her children, the person whose advice and guidance she held above all others, she finds her in the kitchen of Entre Nous being rocked back and forth in a man's arms. Uh-huh, Vivi thinks, who have we here? Then she sees it's JP. Plot twist, Vivi thinks. Savannah and JP hate each other. For the 16 years that Vivi and JP were married, Vivi felt like the baby pulled between her mother and father in that grisly Raymond Carver story. JP felt threatened by Savannah for reasons Vivi could never quite understand. He probably sensed that Vivi's loyalty to Savannah was stronger than her loyalty to him. Savannah, meanwhile, never thought JP was good enough. He's damaged, Savannah used to say. He never knew his father, and he has an unhealthy relationship with his mother. JP is running his hand up and down Savannah's back in a way that seems meant to be comforting. Savannah's breath is shuddering. She must have just finished a good cry. She lifts her face to JP's. Their mouths are inches apart. Their eyes lock. Kiss her, Vivi thinks. Or will that be weird? Well, it will be no weirder than Vivi's novel, The Angle of Light, about two characters who found each other after their respective spouses died. JP and Savannah have lost the same person, her, so their bond would be even stronger. They don't have to fight over Vivi's attention anymore. There's nothing coming between them. Literally nothing. They're hip to hip. Kiss her, Vivi thinks again. JP says, are you going to be okay? I should probably go home. Savannah seems to snap back to her pragmatic self. Yes, of course. I'm sorry I got so emotional. It's just... You're the only person who gets it. I know, JP says. He wipes a tear from Savannah's cheek. Let's do this again next week. And actually eat something. Savannah laughs. How about a week from today? Friday night Sad Sack Supper Club. You got it. JP releases Savannah and takes a step back. How is everything with Amy? Savannah asks. Confusing, JP says. He sighs. I'm going to end things. Ask her to move out. Whoa, Savannah says. Whoa, Vivi thinks. Amy was a mistake, JP says. A 10-year mistake? Savannah says. Come on, JP, you must have feelings for her. I did, JP says, or I thought I did. When I met her, she was young, pretty, sweet, earnest, adoring. I was dazzled by the way she saw me. She made me feel important, and Vivi made me feel like a loser. So I started things with Amy because I wanted to feel good all the time.